Hello, everyone, and welcome to Peace Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network every Thursday at 1 p.m. And you could also find me on theconsciousresistance.com and theseedsofliberty.com. So today we have Skyler Collins coming in from Utah, is it?
Salt Lake City, Utah, yeah.
Salt Lake City, yeah, right. He is a voluntarist and radical unschooler of three kids, a 9-year-old, 5-year-old, and an 8-month-old. He's got a website, everythingvoluntary.com. He's got two books he's written, or booklets. He calls them No Hitting, A Short Guide on Why Spanking is Unnecessary, and Toward a Free Society, A Short Guide on Building a Culture of Liberty. He also runs a website, largeprintliberty.com, where he publishes large editions of libertarian books. And he's got another book coming out at the end of August, before the school year, called, well, he hasn't figured out the name, but the topic is going to be on unschooling and perhaps focused on more the father side, because, you know, the mother does play a role, but definitely, you know, without the father, it's just, it's a lost cause, you know. you need the cohesive unit, right? Man and woman definitely. Together, definitely. So,
yeah.
So Skyler, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So so maybe before we get started, just share with the listeners, you know, your path to voluntarism, you know, what got you interested in it, and what books, podcasts, you know, turned you, you know, transformed your way of thinking.
Well, my journey began when I started reading the weekly columns of Walter Williams and Thomas Sowell, two black economists, and they would write a lot on race and economics, you know, and other things. Walter Williams more explicitly identifies as libertarian. Thomas Sowell is probably more of a Hayekian conservative, I'd say. Anyways, but they got me interested in economics, and so I bought Sowell's Basic Economics and devoured that. And that really kind of jump-started me. I started to recognize how the effects of government regulations and interventions in the economy were, you know, basically making things worse for a lot of people. I mean, things like minimum wage, things like rent control and other things like that, licensing laws. And so then I started to identify these regulations as wrong. And so that's when I then discovered the libertarian philosophy. So then I went through libertarianism, and then, you know, like most people who go through there, they eventually find anarchism. And, you know, when they start applying the libertarian principles consistently, that's when they become anarchists. And then from there, I you know, first heard of this philosophy called voluntarism, and it's a little easier to swallow just semantically with the name voluntarism versus anarchism, because anarchism, you know, generates a lot of different kinds of thoughts with, you know, your typical person. And so, you know, and then I started reading more voluntarist writing and kind of learning more about the differences between voluntarism and voluntarist focus on, focus away from electoral politics, as well as the focus on nonviolence, as a means of, you know, active resistance, and that sort of stuff. So I kind of read a lot of that. Carl Wattner, who publishes the voluntarist, newsletter a few times a year. He's been doing that since the 80s. I read a lot of that stuff, and that's when I started the website, everythingvoluntary.com, because I wanted to kind of have a central place. So it was also after I had discovered voluntarism and I started identifying as a voluntarist, a friend of mine introduced me to a book on parenting called Unconditional Parenting by Alfie Cohn. Now, Alfie Cohn is, I think he's just a typical progressive liberal, but he's written a lot on the demerits of punishments and rewards in parenting as well as in schooling. You know, he's written against like the grade system and that kind of stuff. Anyway, so I read that, and that's when I was like, okay, me using authoritarian parenting, spanking, timeouts, that sort of stuff. Number one, it's inconsistent with my political beliefs, right? If I believe in the voluntary principle or the non-aggression principle, and here I am, violating that in my own house. But what he also convinced me of was that not doing those things is a better way to parent. It's a more effective way to parent when you replace those tools with better tools. And so that turned me into a peaceful parent. And, you know, and then I would buy other books and read those and do what I can to study that and again, start practicing them. At some point, I discovered parent effectiveness training by Thomas Gordon, which is the go-to recommendation I give these days, because that gives you quite a few tools in your parenting, whereas the Alfie Cohn book is more theoretical and it's not as practically useful, although it was a very good, you know, shove in the right direction for me. You know, so I started to realize that putting my kids in school and, you know, where schools are going to introduce rewards and punishments, which is what I was trying to get away with at home, I thought that's going to be counterproductive. So I want to look at other things besides school, as well as I was already fearing school because of the government aspect, because they are government schools and I didn't want my kids learning government versions of history and so forth. So that's when I started looking at, you know, different homeschool philosophies. And I read a book called Thomas Jefferson Education. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, no. Where they talk about structuring time, but not content. And so it's semi-unschooling approach to childhood education. It was from there that I discovered unschooling and then radical unschooling. And that's when I was like, okay, this is all completely consistent, number one, with my principles and values, and number two, this is probably the most compatible form of learning for our for us as a species. You know, Peter Gray, who writes for Psychology Today, he's written a lot on the evolutionary aspect of play-based learning models and that sort of thing. So, I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. And so I did what I could to, I guess you could say, convince my wife, although she's definitely been the reluctant one in our house, which isn't typical, which is why I'm doing the book that I'll explain in a minute. And so that's when we decided to do that. And we gave my son, he was starting kindergarten at the time, and he went a week, and then we went on vacation for a couple of weeks. And then when we came back, we gave him the option, and he said he wanted to stay home. So they've been home ever since. You know, just having a good time, and we do what we can to facilitate their interests. We do what they can to help them have a joyful life. Is kind of our goal, and then, you know, the rest kind of follows after that. So, yeah, that's kind of the journey in a nutshell, I guess you could say.
Nice. You know, one thing I realized when you were saying when you were, you know, talking about your journey, is that all these things like libertarianism, voluntarism, anarchism, peaceful parenting, you know, unschooling, to me, and I think maybe for you also right now, it's like they all gel together, right? They meld mm-hmm. into one, right? And yeah. But the thing is, they're not one. They're separate concepts, and we learn them separately. You know, we had to understand all these things separately, right? And it's kind of
go ahead. We learn them separately, and you're going to learn, you know, really good peaceful parenting advice and really good radical unschooling advice from non-libertarians, you know. I would say most of the big name writers in those two areas are probably progressive liberals. You know, a lot of them are even in Canada in the unschooling. I mean, there's a lot of mm-hmm. Unschooling writing that comes out of Canada. There's kind of a really big unschooling community up there. And so it is interesting. And the reason that's the case is because when the homeschooling movement was sort of taken off through the 60s and 70s, you had the conservatives going to homeschooling, you know, because they wanted to teach religion and keep their kids out of the secular schools. But then you had sort of the progressive liberals wanting to homeschool, but because homeschooling was affiliated and associated with the religious right, they discovered, you know, unschooling and kind of went in that direction, you know, kind of hands-off education as well as religion. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of why you have that liberal progressive strain among you know, veteran radical unschoolers today, which is, I find, is kind of interesting. So, but you do have a lot these days, the last few years, I've definitely seen a lot of libertarians and anarchists learn the idea and then want to move in that direction. And so That's what I've been doing since 2011 when I started the site, is trying to promote these philosophies together as one overall life philosophy, really. As well as when you add things like nonviolent communication to it, when you're talking about just interpersonal relationship skills and that kind of thing too. So,
yeah, it's all about remaining logically consistent, or right, with your principles,
yes.
Right? And in a sense, you know, I guess every statist is not logically consistent. That's the problem, right? Government is the exception, or even let's say a liberal or a conservative who's homeschooling or unschooling. You know, their kids are they don't use what they advocate in government. They don't apply that to their kids. You know, the violence they exempt it from their kids, right? So then if they expand that nonviolent approach, then they would become voluntarists, right?
Yeah.
so yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm definitely trying to do what I can to promote, I guess, the philosophy of liberty on all fronts, and to raise a generation of libertarians, of anarchists, and this is what my first booklet, Toward a Free Society, is about. If we want to achieve a free society, we've got to build a culture of liberty, and I think that can only be done through peaceful parenting and radical unschooling. I think kids need to learn to expect freedom if they're going to feel moral outrage towards its denial.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so like my kids now, because they have been given so much freedom, I mean, and I've said this before, my daughter, almost to an annoying extent, she will insist on her rights, even if they're rights that she's only had for 5 seconds, you know. Immediately it's like, how dare you take this from me, it's mine, you know. And you know, so I really like it, although it's kind of annoying, because I think she's still, of course, learning the social graces and that sort of thing. She does definitely know how to assert her boundaries once she believes that, you know, once she knows where those boundaries are, she's very assertive of them. And I like to see that. And I think that that's the way we need to prepare our children to grow up, not only to keep them personally safe among, you know, petty criminals out there, but also among the giant criminals out there as well, at least to the extent that they can see what they're doing and recognize it for what it really is, rather than being taught that, you know, social contract theory and, you know, the government is like our parents and they take care of us and blah, 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 the things that you learn in school. And so I think
Uncle Sam, right? He's just your uncle. He's just your uncle.
Yeah, he's just
he's a nice guy.
Uncle Sam, big brother, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's probably one of the most, number one, when you look at our sphere of control as individuals, we have no control over the political process at all. And that's why I think voluntarists, and this is at least one of the arguments against participation in politics, is that's completely outside your sphere of control. You cannot affect anything in there. I mean, the most effective way to influence the political arena is what a good friend of mine, Connor Boyack, does. He runs a libertarian think tank here in Utah called Libertas Institute, where he will sit down with legislatures and influence legislation directly. And to me, that is a lot more effective than, you know, simply trying to run for office or just going out and voting or trying to get people to vote. You know what I mean? Because he's because of his efforts, he's helped pass a lot of legislation that's going to be voted on anyways. You know, he's not out there promoting candidates at all, and he's not saying go vote. Mm-hmm. He's saying these guys are here, they're going to vote on something, I'm going to do what I can to influence it. And so he's helped pass a lot of measures to rein back some of the police state. He's trying to get medical marijuana passed here in Utah. Mm-hmm. He's relaxed the already very relaxed homeschooling laws. He's done a lot of good, and that's probably the only area that I've seen where an individual within his sphere of control can be effective when it comes to the political arena. Outside of that, to me, it's just complete waste of time. And so when it comes to sphere of control, your house, right, your home is your sphere of control, and only then to an extent, right? Mm-hmm. Your wife, unless you get violent, is not going to just do anything you want. You've got to persuade her. Same with your kids. Mm-hmm. Again, unless you get violent, unless you use the power, the greater power that you have over them to get your way, you've got to use persuasion. Okay, so, you know, really your sphere of control ends at your fingertips, right? So that's why I think that, you know, every libertarian, every anarchist, every voluntarist should first be a radical in school and a peaceful parent at home. They should be applying these principles every day with their kids, in their families, in their homes. And then that, I think, will be, you know, the kids will grow up and take that out to the world with them. And hopefully that snowball effect will grow and change the surrounding culture and change attitudes towards liberty. And then, you know, along with technological revolution, which is amazing, you know, and that's kind of a thing too. Unschoolers, there's such a high percentage of unschoolers that become entrepreneurs. That's like a thing.
Yeah.
So many of them do. And so that's what we need is more of, as entrepreneurs and thinkers who come up with these great ideas. And mm-hmm. and so going out there, you know, raising unschoolers and, you know, basically raising entrepreneurs, in other words, you know, and parents can approach that differently, and some parents can you know, there's things you can do, I think, to help your kids in that regard. And a lot of parents, myself included, are a little more risk averse, I think, because we were raised with schooling, we were raised with people telling us what to do. Mm-hmm. We're not entrepreneurial minded. I have begun to change that mindset recently, but it's still something that's difficult to do, because you like that safety net, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, so yeah, I think that's just, you know, when we talk about our sphere of control, I think that's the most effective thing we can do is raise the next generation in liberty.
Yeah, yeah. And one interesting thing, my family, I grew up with a family of Democrats. And I mean, I didn't really care about politics, you know, growing up. I just wasn't interested. It wasn't, you know, something that I thought could affect my life in any measurable way. So I focused on other things like, you know, my, you know, philosophy and astronomy and cosmology and things like that, chess, piano. But, you know, as I learned about voluntarism, it simplified politics. And it made sense, you know, and because otherwise, you know, it's like, why would anybody want to care about this referendum or that referendum or this law? Because, you know, even if you do read the law itself, you can barely understand it because the legalese that they use, it's like purposefully made to be obscure, right? And to you know, deter people from wanting to try to understand it themselves, right? And that's unfortunate. And so that's what really got me into it. And so, you know, with the homeschooling and the unschooling, that's been a point of contention with my family a lot. And one of the interesting things is the whole respect your elders idea, you know, like, and which is exactly the reason why I love that they're not in school, is because they don't see a power differential between adults and them, you know, my kids. They, mm-hmm. when they go out into the world, they speak to adults as equals, as peers, right? Because that's how I like to treat my kids, as an equal, as a peer, not as, you know, I'm older, stronger, therefore you respect me just because of that, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's not about respecting your elders just because they're older than you, you know, it's about respecting everybody, or perhaps even respecting only those people that deserve it or that have earned that respect through their actions, right, through their deeds. And so that is something I'm quite proud of, that they're not victim to the appeal to authority, right, that all of us have been, you know, beaten over the head with, you know, one of the unwritten lessons that we learn after the 12 years of indoctrination. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you see that with your kids too, the way they talk to adults?
Yeah, my kids are very respectful. It's actually, it's kind of interesting because I'm always, you know, like my parents will take them for a weekend or whatever, and they'll tell me how wonderful they were. But what's interesting, as soon as me and my wife are back in their lives, that's when sort of the emotional stuff starts to come out. And I think the reason for that is because of the security they feel with us. They allow themselves to be far more emotional with us than they do with, with people they're not as close to. And in my opinion, that shows emotional maturity. Mm. And so they're when we're not around, they get along better with each other. They're a lot more pleasant. They're a lot more respectful of others than when we are around. And I think a typical parent would complain and whine about that, saying, why are you guys so bad? I remember growing up, my mom used to cry and whine about us being more respectful to our teachers than to her. And now I think about it, well, I think it's because, we feel more secure with you. So we allow our emotional side to come out. And remember, we're little kids. Yeah. And we don't have as good a control when we don't feel that pressure to control. And so seeing that in my kids, I think has been pretty cool. So
yeah, that's nice. And that reminds me of another thing. You tell somebody that you're homeschooling or unschooling, and one of the first things they say is, well, if you give kids the freedom to do what they want, they're just going to play games all day, go on the computer, play video games, they're just going to waste their day the way, end up, worthless bum with no skills, and one thing that I like to point out is that perhaps when a child is forced to go to an institution for 8 hours a day and then come home and then they have to do additional homework where they can't do what they want to do, right? So more time is taken away. And then, maybe even during the week, they barely can do anything they want to do because they got to go to bed because they got to wake up at 6 the next morning. So maybe the weekends is the only time they can do whatever they want to do. And so they don't want to do anything related to books or dittos or papers. And they just want to play video games the whole time or watch TV because they're like deprogramming. That's their relaxation. And so the conclusion is, you see, if he could do what he wanted, he would do that all the time.
I'm sure there's a logical fallacy there. I don't know what it's called, but yeah, just to take that idea that, I mean, number one, when you give them time to do what they want, that's their time and they're going to soak up as much of that fun stuff as possible. Mm-hmm. But when every hour is their time, that's not what happens. The kids aren't using what they're doing as an escape, right? And that's, mm-hmm. I don't know if you've done any studying on addiction. My podcast co-host Phil Eager has taught me a little bit, channeling Gabor Mate, who's done a lot on addiction. And nice. What addiction is, in his opinion, and it makes sense to me, is addiction is escapism. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's right. When your life either has been or currently is, 90 on the happiness scale. Mm-hmm. You do something or you consume something that takes your happiness up to 130, 140. Mm-hmm. And then when you're not doing that thing, you drop back down to 90 or even below that. Mm-hmm. You long for that happiness again. And so over and over, the more you do that, that thing becomes your escape. And that's where addiction is born. Now, I think with people who are not traumatized as children and are not traumatized in their day-to-day life with other people telling them what to do, their default happiness level is more like 120. And so when they do those things, it takes it up to maybe 130. But there's not as big of a difference in the two states of happiness. And so they don't crave for that as much as the person who's got a default happiness level of a lot lower. That's kind of my understanding in a nutshell of Gabor Mate's approach to addiction, and I think he's done some research that has supported that. So yeah, I think kids can become addicted to video games, and it's because video games are a form of escape from their lives, their miserable lives for them. And so they want that every chance they get. But when you look at that situation as a person and say, if we took away school, he'd be doing that all day long. I think that's true for 6 months while they're in that de-schooling process, which is a thing that people who are transitioning from schooling to unschooling, especially if their kids have been in school for a few years, they need to pay attention to, and they need to realize that there is going to be a de-schooling. And there's a lot of good writing that you can read on what that looks like and how to deal with that as a family. Then, yeah, I think your kid is going to use that to de-school. He's going to be on there 24/7. But at some point, it's going to be easy to get him off it to do a different activity. It's not going to be a fight and a struggle, because it's not like he's holding on to his drugs and saying, no, you can't have it. This is my alcohol, or this is, you know what I mean? Because it's no longer an escape for him, because his general contentment level has risen back up to where a healthy person's should be. So, yeah, I mean, my kids, you know, they're, it's very easy to say, okay, let's go do this activity and leave the house. But when we don't have anything scheduled, they are either on the TV or they're on the computer. But when they're on the computer, they're either, you know, browsing YouTube or they're playing a game. Most of the time, they're on Skype with friends, oftentimes multiple friends, doing something cooperative in some video game, whether it's Minecraft or Gary's Mod or, you know, Quake Live or whatever. And so, I mean, play is the best way to approach education for children. I mean, that's in our DNA. We are a play-based species, right? That's what Peter Gray talks about. So if they're playing and they're having a joyful life, then when the time comes for them to learn maybe like a skill, right, like math, reading, writing, those are skills. Mm-hmm. Those aren't facts, right? There's two things you'll learn, either facts or skills. Mm-hmm. Then they're going to be ready and eager to learn that, because it's like an achievement in a video game. You know, they've got to learn this to go to the next level, and they see that. And so when they're ready to learn it, they just will. And I mean, unschoolers all the time are reporting on their kids picking up a book and teaching themselves to read. Now, I don't think that's in general what it is. I think it might take some more hands-on with mom and dad reading to them, and we read to our kids every night. You know, and you know, they're always looking at text on the screen. You know, my son can read now. My wife taught him to read, and he kind of solidified that through preschool. And then my daughter, she's, you know, they do letter games and stuff with her, you know, completely voluntary, and she loves it, and it's fun, and she's learning her letters. And at some point, because so much text is around her, she's gonna start reading. I don't have any doubt of that. So, and you know, and then the, you know, later on in a few years, it'll be mathematics. You know, at some point, you know, my son, he's never really had formal mathematics lessons, but he can do basic addition and subtraction. And, you know, when the time comes for him to learn the higher forms of math, multiplication, division, fractions, you know, depending on where his passions take him, I don't think that's, you know, it's going to be. I mean, just like he's got to turn on the computer to use it, he's got to learn this skill in order to do what he wants to do. And you see that with unschoolers all the time is when it's time, when they need the prerequisite skill to do what they really want to do, they pick it up no problem. And if he's learning multiplication or division at 12, he's going to pick it up in a day. I have no doubt of that. I mean, you can't tell me that a 16-year-old, you know, can't learn to do what we all learn to do at 8 years old. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. His mind is developed enough that it's very easy to pick up these very simple concepts, you know. So it's not anything I'm worried about. But a lot of people are worried about that, especially when they see that unschoolers don't put a lot of emphasis on some of those skills. You know, the emphasis is really, what is your passion and let's help you do it. And then the skills sort of come, mm-hmm. sort of happen organically along the way. But, you know, there is that fear, and so there is a lot of reluctancy. So that's why I decided to put together, to edit a book written by unschooling dads for wives who want to move into unschooling, either from schooling or from homeschooling, a more structured homeschooling. They want to move into unschooling, but their husbands are reluctant, you know, at any degree, either a little bit reluctant or a lot. So I wanted to, you know, I put the call out there for unschooling dads all along the spectrum, from people who don't even have kids yet that are already convinced of unschooling, to people whose kids are adults now. And I'm like, can you write me a chapter? Here's some things to think about, and just pretty much, you know, what's your experience been? Just give it to me in your words, you know. And it's not scholarly or anything like that. And so that's the call I put out. I got maybe 30 commitments. I've received a little less than half of that, with, you know, a couple weeks left on kind of a semi-hard deadline. I would like to get it all together. And I'm editing these as they come in, and then I just got to put it in a file and get a cover made, and then I can publish that. And my goal is by the end of August, so that moms can give it to their husbands when their kids are just starting the school year and, you know, pull them out before it's too late.
Right.
Before the dads say, oh, he's already halfway done with the year, let's let him finish. It's like, no, the year just started, let's just pull him right back out.
Yeah.
Or, you know, stop whatever homeschooling we're doing, or at least transition towards.
Mm-hmm.
For homeschoolers, it's often best to kind of slowly transition towards less and less mm-hmm. control over structure and content. So,
yeah, you brought up a lot of points I wanted to talk about. One of them is, you know, the idea of deferred gratification when you go to school. It's like you were saying, you know. When kids go to public school, they can't do what they want to do because they have to go to this institution. They have to listen. They have to memorize for the test. They have to do all these things that they don't want to do voluntarily. And so when they do get the time to do what they want to do, they cram it as much as possible with, you know, everything that's not school. And when you don't do that to the kids, when you don't force them to do things, and like you said, when all their time, when you know, most of the day is their day, then they don't need to escape, right? Like, what a radical idea, you know?
Right.
You know, stop, you know, I mean, some people even equate, you know, government schools to child abuse, which I would certainly consider, because, you know, although, you know, it's that would be difficult to tell somebody, like your parents or your family, you know, especially if they're trying to convince you of sending your kids to public school. It's like, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the blind leading the blind, you know, the abused traumatic minds, you know, trying to do, you know, propagate that cycle of violence throughout, you know, the future generations. And they just don't see that, you know. It's like, it's the idea of force, you know, like, you know, kids are born lacking, right? They're born as blank slates, you know, they're born without souls, without spirits, without passion, without drives, and it's our job to imprint our whims and desires onto them, because they don't have a soul, they don't have a spirit, they don't know what they want, right? They're just kids. You know, this is the idea.
Well, yeah, that or they're born with an evil soul. It's got to be stamped out of them,
tamed. Yeah. Well, yeah. It's probably more applied with the boys too, right? That you know,
yeah.
In general, boys, you know, need more physical activity than the girls, and so it's like, and so the boys seem to be, you know, in general, more heavily medicated and, you know, zombified conform, right, to the classroom setting, which is so horrible, you know. And then you said before about, you know, how some parents of, you know, about government schools, they worry when they talk to unschoolers and homeschoolers, you know, like, well, what if they don't learn math and science and history and all this stuff? You know, what if they don't learn their division? What if they don't learn? I was turned onto a video, a TED talk by this math teacher in a public school who, the subject of the TED talk was, you know, the math that everyone needs to know is basically what you would need to buy a carpet from from the store. That's the extent of the math that everyone really needs to know to be applied to daily life, you know, the whatever you need to buy a carpet, which basically could be taught, like, you know, within a couple weeks or months or something. But yeah, so he's basically telling this audience that no, most of the stuff you learn is useless, is not necessary, is a waste of time. And when you force kids to learn something that is a waste of time, you're robbing them of their life, right? Of their potential.
Mm-hmm.
You're destroying their potential. And this is what I tell people, like, especially my family members who like to argue with me about this, is it's the idea of the seen and the unseen, right? Bastiat seen and the unseen, right? Everybody's like,
mm-hmm.
Well, look at you. You went to public school and you turned out okay, right? But
mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, the scene, right? That's for you, you know, like, you know, they say without government, we would have, you know, we have NASA, we have, you know, all these bridges and roads, and we have all these cool military stuff. You know, isn't that awesome? That's what they see. But what's not seen is the potential that has been annihilated, you know, as a result of all the force that was instituted to bring about those things, right? So, you know, public school is about force, it's about compulsion, but people choose not to see the gun, right? And then you bring up, you know, and I bring up, you know, compulsory laws and truancy, you know, what does the truant officer do? You know, he's not your friend. He doesn't want to be your friend. But if you, you know, sign your kid up for public school and you don't go, you're going to get a visit from the truancy officer, right? And he's going to do nasty things to your parents if you don't go to school. So it's not a nice thing. You know, there is violence in the background.
Yeah, there is. I was just, you know, when I think back, my middle school and junior, or excuse me, my junior high and high school, we called it middle school, years were probably the worst years of my life. I was very depressed. I was very angry. And I attribute that to not having any freedom, you know, not being able to do the things I wanted to do and having all of these unchosen liabilities thrown on me. And I think back what, you know, had I not been forced to go to school, what would my life during those years have been? If I'd have had the choice to choose, you know, the path that I was on. And it is kind of, you know, it's easy to kind of get angry about that, especially towards the people who, you know, were, you know, responsible for creating that situation, you know, the parents, teachers, you know, but when you know, it's easy to get angry, but then it's also easy to kind of see themselves as victims of that same system. And you know, it just goes back to that first guy who thought it would be better to force somebody else to give him his resources rather than going and finding them themselves, that you know, that idea of conquest was born. And from there, you know, you have large-scale conquest, which is statism, and then the state creates schools, and which was a brilliant move by them, by the way, to create, you know, to eventually create a compliant citizenry. You know, you indoctrinate them. You know, so it goes back centuries, and so it's, you know, it's hard to be angry at anything. And I don't know. I mean, I think it can be healthy at least to recognize it, and then to look in your own lives of where you're contributing to that, and then ceasing to do that, you know, which a lot of people are doing now. A lot of libertarians are finally doing that, taking their kids out of schools, and you know, they're stopping to spank and that sort of stuff. And so that's why I do what I do with the website, with my writing, with my books. I mean, it is part hobby, but it's also part crusade, I guess. I never actually said it like that. Yeah, it's kind of my righteous crusade, is to spread the message of peace, I think. And so, you know, that's what I try to do. And that's exactly what you're doing, you know, and maybe someday you will write a book. And, you know, and if you are writing regularly now, that will form a book at some point, you know, and you just do it, you know. And I do it not expecting to make any money from it. You know, I don't have ads on my website or anything like that. We do ask for donations on the podcast, and we've gotten, you know, $50 here and there. It's certainly nothing to live on.
Quit your day job.
But it's just, it's a labor of love, and it's, you know, I just, it is selfish, because I want people around me to share my values, and I want to live in a free society. And so I selfishly am trying to teach people how to do that.
Selfishly.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it is. I mean, it's self-interest. Everybody, you know, I want to see other people mimic my values. And I don't know, it's probably part confirmation and part I just want to live in a better world, and I want my children to. So.
Yeah, one thing that it reminded me of is when I was in high school, I was interested in philosophy, Eastern and Western philosophy, and I was reading a little bit on Confucianism. And one Confucius quote that I remember is, if you want to change the world, first, you change yourself. Mm-hmm. And then that will translate out to your family, right? And then that will affect your neighbor and your town and then your village and then the state and then the country, right? It always starts with the individual, right? Always. And that's the thing that a lot of people tend to overlook, when, because I get this all the time from people who advocate for government school, is, you know, they say you're so selfish because your kids need the proper preparation to so that they can be a functioning member of society, right? It's always the mention of the society, right? We, the collective, things like that. And that kind of idea of looking at the society, forget about the individual, it's all about the society, right? The collective. That is exactly what Hitler did his whole campaign on, right? And same thing with every single politician, basically. It's all about the collective, right? Society, what's good for society, right? And that's such a dangerous way of thinking, right? The hive mentality, collectivist approach, you know? And that is exactly the precursor to things like democide, right? Of a population when the people's liberties have been trampled on so much that they're just unrecognizable. they don't have any, you know, there's no individuality whatsoever. And that's definitely the trajectory that we're on, you know? When you keep talking about what's good for society, what's good for society, you know, what's good for society in terms of voluntarism is what's good for the individual. If it's not good for the individual, it's not good for society.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. If it's not good for the individual, it's not good for the society. But in the same vein, I think that, you know, I mean, we did evolve in tribes, right? We did evolve in large, small tribes, large families, right? And so I think, you know, I think some of that tribalism is kind of coming through there and kind of informing some of those ideas. But it's people who are bent on conquest that are using those sentiments to, you know, taking it to a dangerous extreme, which the state is a very extremist institution. I think in a free society, if we were in a stateless society, number one, I think it would need to be preceded by a culture of liberty, which I talk about in the book. But peaceful parenting and radical unschooling, which are two parts of that culture of liberty, that has an effect of binding families together as well as encouraging families through that bond to share with one another. And so I think it's very likely that in a free society, you would have, and I don't know if we would call it communism or socialism among family units, but then when those family units trade with other family units, you would have markets, you know, because a lot of that is just, you know, people are just selling stuff to people they don't know, you know, over great distances. And so you would have markets, large scale markets, but then closer to home, and whether it's, you know, family based or even maybe just neighborhood based, I think you would see a lot of the sharing type economy and sort of that voluntary communism or voluntary socialism to an extent, I think. I mean, just in my own home, you know, I share everything with my kids. You know, they have free access. They got to take turns on it. But, you know, so just in my home, we share all of our resources. But those resources come into the home through the market. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So I think that's the extent. And so I think, you know, there's a level of the socialism or the communism that is compatible with human nature. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the family. Yeah. I do not believe it's past that point, though. Maybe, you know, family-based traditional neighborhoods where everybody did grow up together and it is sort of kind of an extended non-blood family. Some of that stuff, you know, I think there'd be a lot of sharing and that sort of thing. But resources, unless they're grown or made in that community, got to come in through markets. And so that's the extent of I see it, the compatibility with those ideas with human nature. So.
Yeah, and the same thing with democracy, you know, socialism and democracy. It's like they function well on very, very small scales, right? Like say, in a family or in a club or in, let's say, in a church or whatever. Like, you know, small scales, yeah, you know, you're in a chess club and, yeah, they take a vote, you know. And that's not evil, you know. It's just, it's like, it's a voluntary association. You can leave if you want. You're not forced to be there, you know. You don't have to pay taxes against your will. And the same thing with, yeah, I definitely agree that the family unit is more reminiscent of socialism, yeah. And yeah, you're right. The problem is that people assume, like, you know what? If this works for the family, maybe we should force everyone to be like this.
Yeah.
That's the problem, right? Because with the family, you know, you're intimately connected with these people, and so, yeah, family are more likely to share, or maybe your close neighbors, you know, you're more likely to share. But people that you don't know and that you don't have, you know, you're not friends with, you know, why should they share with you? And you can't force them to share if they don't want to, right? Because then you're violating their individual liberties, right? So same thing with democracy. It just does not work when you enlarge it on a grand scale. You know, it just degenerates into tyranny and oppression, you know, because, you know, and in those large scale, you know, economies, yeah, definitely, you know, free market capitalism is, you know, in my opinion, I guess we're biased, you and I, confirmation bias, but it seems that when the markets are free, there is the maximum prosperity, right, and growth and wealth that's created out of that, right, because it's only the individuals that know, so, yeah.
Well, even in our statist world, the states that allow the highest degrees of economic freedom, the highest degrees of functioning markets, show the highest amounts of wealth,
oh, yeah.
As well as peace. Mm-hmm. You know, so yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, taking that to that conclusion of, okay, let's extend markets into these other realms. Let's extend markets into, you know, dispute resolution and into security, into these other things that the state, you know, economic regulations and whatever. Let's just extend markets and create markets in these different areas, and I think things would be better again and again and again. So
at the same time, you know, talking about socialism in the family, another thing that I've heard Stefan Molyneux say, and I kind of like this idea, is that, you know, helping kids to be, you know, encourage responsibility, self-reliance is on, you know, they can share their things if they want to, right? But if, like, you give a present to your kid, then obviously there's a transfer, right? You're given the present, it's theirs, it's their property, and so they can do with it what they will, right? They can, you know, enjoy it, they can share it, or they can destroy it. And if they do destroy it, then it's that's kind of like a lesson, right? Like that resources are scarce and finite, and to replace that requires money or currency, which must be obtained through adding value, right? Providing value to society, to the market, right? So, so I, at the same time, that's a valuable lesson. What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my kids have their own personal property. I mean, they understand that, you know, the electronics, the big electronics, computers, you know, were purchased by me at one point. Mm-hmm. You know, TV, all that stuff. You know, the lights are powered through, you know, the bills are paid by me, the house is bought by me. And so they understand that. But they have a lot of their own property. I mean, they're constantly given money by grandparents and stuff. It's a Mexican tradition called Domingo. It's kind of like allowance. When you see grandma on Sunday, she gives you a dollar. And so they collect dollars on the weekends. And they save those, and then they buy plushies, or, you know, they'll ask for money for their birthday present that they did last year. And then they had, you know, over $100 each, and they my daughter bought a tablet, my son bought a PSP. You know, so they have these things that are theirs, and they're completely theirs to control. I can't, and I won't take them from them or even attempt to.
Yeah, yeah.
And even my stuff like computers and video games, I don't limit their use of them at all in any way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they learn self-regulation by self-regulating. Mm-hmm. You know, the only I don't really want to call it a rule, I want to call it, I guess, more of a principle, is that when there is a limited number, like right now, they kind of both use their own computers. We have three computers in the house, the one I'm using right now, and then there's two others. And so they can play their each of their computers, and there's no conflict. But like, there's only one big TV with the Amazon Fire TV on it. And so if there's something on there they want to use, they've got to take turns. And so they understand the concept of taking turns. Other than that, there's no limits.
Mm-hmm.
Other than how they use it, I mean, they can't be destructive towards it or anything like that. And if they are, then they know that I'll be unhappy, and mm-hmm. you know, then I'll probably seek restitution by confiscating their.
Yeah. It's, you know. It's hard, you know. Like for me, before I had kids and my wife too, you know, I remember having a conversation like, so when we have kids, if they misbehave, we're going to spank, right? And we said, yeah, I guess we'll spank. You know, it just makes sense. So, like, it wasn't given a second thought. And the reason was, I think, because we were both treated like that as children. Yeah. And so, you know, it only makes sense. It's just, what's that? The appeal to antiquity. You know, if my parents did it, their parents did it, why wouldn't I do it?
Right.
Everybody's doing it, so just do it. thankfully, when my son was born, he was just around one, my wife sent me the Stephen Molyneux Truth About Spanking video, and changed my world. And
excellent.
And that's how I learned about, you know, through that I learned about, you know, volunteerism and free markets and things like that. So nice. That was my introduction to peaceful parenting as well. And so I'm very, very grateful to him. You know, he's done so much great work in that sense, you know. So I really am a fan of his work. But yeah, so the spanking is it's just amazing how it's so automatic to some people, you know, like your kid does something bad, you hit him, you know, just a little tap. It's just, you know, and it's funny when people try to distinguish, you know, it's not abuse. I'm not abusing him. I'm just disciplining him. And he understands that I love him when I hit him, which is the most schizophrenic way of describing it, right? He understands I'm doing this because I love you. It's, oh my God. It's very painful. But yeah, it's amazing how these things are so ingrained in so many people, you know? And then the double standard of, you know, like, you know, you hit your friend, it's assault, you hit your wife, it's, you know, domestic abuse, and you hit your child, it's discipline. And it's acceptable, right?
Yeah, I have a chapter on discipline in my spanking book, my no hitting. That talks about discipline and, you know, discipline. The root of discipline is disciple, which means to guide, you know, a disciple, somebody who follows you. So discipline is guiding somebody. Mm-hmm. And so this euphemism that, well, spanking is already a euphemism for, you know, hitting your kid.
Yeah.
And then discipline is a euphemism for spanking. And so you've got this, you know, 2 degrees away from what you're actually doing to try to make it sound more palatable, I guess. But anyway, so my wife grew up in Mexico City, and she was never spanked, she was never yelled at, or anything, you know, and her family bond with her parents and her sisters is very strong. But when my son got old enough where I felt I needed to start spanking him, probably around 3 years old, it was hard for her to see me do that. But as I did it, eventually that resistance broke down in her, and then she started doing it.
Oh.
You know, but it took some time to break through that, you know, her resistance to that idea, because she wasn't raised with that. So had I not been there, or had I had a different attitude at the time, you know, my kids never would have been spanked, and she would have never even considered spanking, you know, because she didn't consider spanking until I was like, no, it's okay, you know, and convincing her that it's okay and this and that. And biggest regret of my life is ever doing that. So anyways, obviously we don't do it now. We haven't done it for 4.5 years. So he was 5 when we stopped. Anyway, so yeah, people who aren't raised that way, which I hope when my kids are older now, like, my son, I mean, he remembers it, and so he could have some, you know, some scars there, in, you know, from his past, and it might come out, and he might feel the urge to spank his kids. I hope not. My other kids, my daughter, you know, I hope that they'll, you know, approach it like my wife did, like a completely foreign idea. Why would I ever hit a kid? You know, so that's my hope.
Yeah. Yeah, I interviewed Dana Martin, the Radical Unschooler. I'm sure you've heard of her. And one thing that she said with me that stayed with me was, kindness is revolutionary. And isn't that such a shocking statement that we have to make? Like, what kind of society are we living in that kindness is revolutionary?
You know? Yeah.
And it just illustrates the undercurrent of violence that, you know, permeates our society, you know, and, you know, starts in a home with authoritative parenting, spanking, you know, corporal punishment, and, you know, and then in public schools, you know, with, all the crap that they put up with, and, you know, just destroying their creativity and their imagination, their desire, their will, their love of learning is completely, you know, snuffed out. And so yes, it's a cycle of violence, right? And so I love it that what we're doing is we're breaking that cycle. I really love that. And it's like we're going against the current, you know. It's like the whole river is going this way and we're going this way. And everyone else is like, what are you doing? Turn around. What are you doing? You're like, no, this is immoral. We're going this way. Sorry. we're trying to change the current, right? Going the other way.
Yeah, that can be a really tough thing, especially when you're alone and you're you know, I mean, as an anarchist or libertarian, you're already within your neighborhoods and whatever, you're already pretty much alone in your beliefs and usually among your families. And then you've got to add insult to injury and become a peaceful parent and an unschooler. You really are making things stressful for yourself. And those things can be stressful when you do have that opposition from people who are so close to you. So what I highly recommend doing is finding other local unschoolers, you know, just like you would find other local libertarians. Find the unschooling groups in your area and really start to get involved with them. Here in Salt Lake, we have, it started with me, Phil, my co-host, and another friend of ours. We got together to have dinner one Saturday night and just, you know, talked about things and just kind of had that adult interaction that we didn't really get a lot of being so involved with our kids. Mm-hmm. And then we were like, hey, let's invite more people from this. So the next month, we invited more people. And we've been going on over about a year and a half now. And we call it Epic Night of Epicness. So it's every it's every fourth Saturday. We go to a village inn, which is a diner, you know, like a Denny's. I don't know if you have any of those where you live.
Yeah.
And we just, you know, people come. You know, the couple hours that we're there, people come at any time. Most people kind of show up at the beginning, and we just eat and chat and just kind of support each other in what we're doing, you know. And we're all either unschoolers or partial unschoolers, or, you know, one lady, she's got a couple daughters that are preteens, but they really like school, and so they're in school, but it's really their choice because she doesn't force them to go or anything, and she's more than happy to let them stay home. I think they just like the social aspect. That's kind of what hooks kids too, is the friends and the social aspect, and they don't want to go home and then lose those friends. And so that's
exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, and so that's something we've been doing, and we even have bowling nights quarterly. This weekend we actually have our first family retreat with the group. It's called Epic Family Retreat of Epicness, and it's north at a place called Bear Lake, which is a huge lake, very blue water. It's got great beaches. Mm-hmm. And we'll just be at a resort right there on the beach, and there's probably 10 families that are going to be there, and we're just going to have, you know, two nights of just awesome fun. So it's what you got to do. You've got to find like-minded individuals, whether it's politics or the unschooling and the peaceful parenting, and then you've got to weekly do what you can to get together and get something started to where you can support each other. Since we've been doing that, things have been easier. You know, I haven't felt as much like a rebel, as a loner, as somebody who's not, you know, somebody swimming against the current, because now I've got, you know, a school of fish swimming with me against the current.
Cool.
And we support each other. And so I definitely recommend that if you're going to go on this path, try to find local people. And you'll find a lot of, you'll find, if you're looking for unschooling groups, which you should find, and you could just find these groups on Facebook pretty easily, a lot of those people probably won't be libertarians. They'll just be, you know, unschoolers and, you know, who probably came from homeschooling. And that's good. You definitely need that support too. And a lot of times they organize activities that you can do together. And your kids, my kids have made friends with people in these groups, and they play online with them. And, you know, my daughter's got a best friend who's a kid, and we're good friends with the parents. And those parents happen to be anarchists too, which is cool. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so, you know, you do. And because they're already kind of in that counterculture as unschoolers, they're kind of already thinking about those. I mean, they don't identify it as anarchist ideas, but they're kind of already leaning that way, which is kind of cool. Because then as you talk with them and get to know them, you kind of get that you could feel that anti-establishment attitude coming from, which is great because that can segue into a lot of cool conversations while the kids are playing. So, yeah, I definitely recommend doing that, getting yourself a group, a community together. It's going to make your experience a lot better. So,
the way you just described that is basically the primary argument that I say, or the primary response I say to people, you know, what about the socialization? Because they have this idea that when I say homeschooling, I don't usually say unschooling because like homeschooling is radical enough for most people. I just say homeschooling. And so they're like, it's like they think that, you know, I lock my kids in a room, throw in books, maybe, you know, push food under the door, and that's it. That's the extent. You know, read that. You know, do your homework, and it's like whatever they do in school, that's what we're doing at home. And I have to, you know, explain, you know, what the whole passion-driven education, and you know, find out what their interests are and everything. And also, that's actually, you're right. It's an excellent thing to do. We do not spend, like every day we go out, basically. Every day we go out and we do meet new people. There are a bunch of Facebook groups I'm a part of, and I meet a bunch of families around here, and yeah, there's a good amount of them. But I think, I met just one family. The guy, the father is a, he listens to Stefan Molyneux, so he's kind of a voluntarist, but I'm definitely much more into it than he is, but that's the closest I've come. Everybody else is not an anarchist or a voluntarist at all, and so it's kind of funny. You know, I meet all these people, and the common denominator is, you know, homeschooling, which is great, but that's just the beginning. You know, then you can get in slowly. You know, not coercively, of course, but slowly start talking about, you know, if government can't do public school right, then what else can they not do? Right, so I find it helpful to get people to think about everything else and volunteerism and things like that. So we're always with people. We're always, you know, going out. Like tomorrow, we're gonna go to the city. We're gonna go to a Liberty Science Museum. Really exciting. It's gonna be their second time there. So they're really excited about that with their friends. This other family with their two kids. Always, you're right, always have to get out, you know, and meet new people, and, you know, and of course, it's not like the sterile, homogeneous environment in the government schools where, like, everybody is the same age. Of course not, you know, you go out in public and everybody's different ages, and that's the beautiful thing, that everybody is different ages, you know? That's how they learn the best, right, when they're around older kids and younger kids, you know? So I absolutely love that. I don't want to keep you too long, but is there anything that you want to finish up with? Any message that you would give to, people, prospective homeschoolers or unschoolers that are unsure, like maybe on the fence, and, you know, what kind of, message would you give them?
Well, if you're on the fence about unschooling and whether you're still a schooler or a homeschooler, I would meet other unschooling families, and one of the best ways to do that is to go. A couple of years ago, we went to an unschooling conference in Vancouver, Washington. They have these at hotels, you know, and they just have different workshops and panels where grown unschoolers or, you know, adults whose kids are older, they just get up and talk about unschooling, and it gives you a chance to sort of see the unschooling community up close and personal, as well as to meet and to chat with kids who are not, or adults who grew up this way, and to really feel the energy that comes from them and to see really what it's all about. I mean, there's the conference there. There's a conference in San Diego. There's one, in Phoenix, Arizona. There's one in Albuquerque, New Mexico. There's some in Minnesota. There's some in Ohio. I think even in New Hampshire, there's one in Texas. They're all over. Just go to Google and search unschooling conference, and you'll find something that's probably not more than a 10-hour drive at the most from where you're at. There's even a couple of unschooling summer camps. That's like 2-week-long summer camps, one in Portland and one in, I think, Tennessee, called the Not Back to School Camp. I'm hoping to get my kids interested in when they're teenagers, because I think that could be a really fun experience for them. So you really just got to immerse yourself in the unschooling world in order to eventually get it and say, okay, this is what we want to do. It's like that with anything, though. You know, you got to immerse yourself in it. You know, if you're going to learn a new language, you got to immerse yourself in it. So.
Yeah, definitely. That's and actually, just before we go, I just want to let you know, I interviewed this woman. Her name is Betty Ann, and she is 55, and she has 5 kids. And the first 3, she unschooled in the 80s.
Yeah.
So you can imagine how now, with the internet, you know, with Skype, with all these lightning fast transmission of ideas that's available to us, even now, people and all the resources available, people are still skeptical and unsure about homeschooling and unschooling. Imagine at that time in the 80s, calling yourself, and actually she didn't even know the term unschooling until she read like John Holt and other writers like that, and she's like, oh, unschooling, that's what we're doing.
he coined it, yeah.
Yeah, right. So it was amazing, and she was basically the only one in her neighborhood doing it. So, but still, her kids, you know, became good friends with the kids going to school in her neighborhood, and so they still had a great time, and one thing, because she had mostly daughters, and one thing that the daughters were worried about of not going to school is, you know, nobody's going to ask me to the prom. and so what ended up happening is they got asked so many times to so many different proms that they ended up going to more proms than a typical kid in public school, which is really funny. So yeah, you're right. You got to immerse yourself, you know, don't be shy, go out, meet other people. And you know, it helps. Yeah, I mean, it encourages, you know, the parents to be social if they're not naturally social, and the kids, they just thrive in that, you know, meeting new kids. My kids are so excited whenever we go out and I say, you know, we're going to meet a new family, and they get so excited, you know, yay, new kids, you know. So, yeah, it's a beautiful thing. So before we go, can you just plug your websites and your books once again, just so people don't forget it?
Yeah, just everythingvoluntary.com. Hit the publications link at the top. You can see the books there. Hit the podcast link at the top. The podcast is sort of kind of slowed right now, trying to get it ramped back up. My co-host and I both have gone through some transitions in our life. I'm in a new job. He's a stay-at-home dad now. And so things have been kind of slow. We are planning on recording in a couple days. Everythingvoluntary.com, largeprintlibrary.com. You can get to all of those things at SkylarJCollins.com, which is my personal website, which is really just kind of contains links to all my stuff. So,
awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Very good. Awesome conversation, Skylar. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. So if anybody wants to donate to this show, except Bitcoin or PayPal, just like Skylar said, this is a labor of love. You know, we're not making we're not rolling in the dough as a result of this. although, you know, rolling in the dough would be fiat currency dough, so it'd be worthless anyway. But anyway, so we're not rolling in we're not rolling in anything, but we are doing it as a passion, spreading ideas, because that's how you change the course of history, right? It's only through the spread of ideas. You know, it's not through violence, it's, you know, not through Molotov cocktails. It's through talking, educating, and you know, informing people about what's possible when you take violence out of the equation. You know, what an amazing idea.
Living
by example, exactly. Living by example is the best way to teach your kid is, you know, words are one thing, but when your actions contradict your words, then you got a problem. and they end up confused too. So, very cool. Thank you very much, Skylar. Awesome conversation. So this is Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network and theseedsofliberty.com and theconsciousresistance.com. Wishing everyone have a wonderful day. Take care. Bye.